Support for Extra 106.3 comes from Natural Body Spa and Skin Remedy, celebrating their 35th anniversary and offering gift cards in-store and online. You can discover Mother's Day and anniversary presents online at Natural Body Spa and Skin Remedy at naturalbody.com.
This is the Ben Burnett Show, the only show in America that features a one-term has-been retired politician that nobody knows.
Welcome into the Ben Burnett Show. My name is Ben Burnett. Today's guest is former United States Senator David Perdue. David, welcome in.
Well, thanks, Ben. I look forward to our conversation.
Man, it is good to talk to you. I haven't seen you in a while. How have things been? You been on vacation?
Well, since May, we've been getting our life back in order after 9 years of what some people would call public service. But, we've seen our grandkids more in the last couple months, and I have one right now in Little League in the Little League World Series brackets that are trying to, you know, survive their way up. But, yeah, we're enjoying life, getting my own personal matters in order again, and so it's all been good.
Well, I wanted to wander through your career to this point. Talk about growing up in Macon and where did you go to school?
Wow. I was born in Macon. My mom and dad were school teachers in Houston County, and they lived in Warner Robins. We had a big family there. My dad's family was in Bon Air, and I grew up working on their farms and so forth, went to public schools. My mother was a fifth grade teacher when I was in the first grade, and my dad was the principal of that little school. I met my wife in the first grade, believe it or not. And anyway, she and I graduated there, and then I went to Tech and graduated from there. But, you know, growing up in Middle Georgia, working on those farms and all that, it was a great childhood. I played baseball and that kind of thing. And it was a military town, so we didn't know a lot of the things that were surrounding us and around in the South and that kind of thing. And there were kids who had been all over the world were in my classes. So we got a very good briefing just naturally talking to all these friends and kids in that town who had lived all over the world. And so in my career, I ended up living all over the world. So it was a good background to do what I've done, and I was very blessed.
When you get when you finish at Georgia Tech and you go into the workforce, like one of the things that I think as many people know it as don't is that don't know it are that you sat as the CEO and chairman of the board of some really enormous companies that everybody knows.
Well, I certainly didn't start out there, and that's one of the things I see a lot of young, aggressive people. They want to be there maybe too quickly, and I was like that too, where everybody's aggressive. But before I got there, Ben, I had a career that started out. I worked my way through Georgia Tech, and that's a real true story. I mean, I literally worked construction and ended up working in a warehouse there in Atlanta to get out of Georgia Tech. And then I went with a consulting firm. And the reason I went with a consulting firm right out of school was I figured, you know, I need to go out and learn something. I mean, I had all this book learning, but I didn't have any practical experience in business. And so that was very interesting. I worked all over the world with that company and lived in Europe a couple places, and later in my career lived in Asia. But that business career was basically dealing with consumer products, consumer services, and that sort of thing. And getting a responsibility as a CEO and trying to run a company, if you haven't paid your dues all along and suffered through, you know, some tough times, it's really a difficult job. I found it pretty easy from the standpoint that I got pulled into some pretty big turnarounds, and we were gratefully, we were successful in doing that. But it was all because of the people. I mean, the people that
right.
I was fortunate to have around me, the people that we hired, the people that we developed. It was all about that. I can tell you story after story after story. I mean, we turned Reebok around with three young women in their early 30s. It's a very fascinating story. But my career is nothing but a testament of the successes of all those people around me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when you kind of evaluate, and I know you, it is well documented that you like turnaround situations. I'm going to ask you a question that you cannot answer with the state of Georgia. Where is the most unique place you have ever lived in the world?
Most unique. Wow. Probably Singapore.
Yeah, I believe it. Singapore. What do you like about it, that it's an island?
Well, it was a melting pot. I mean, you had Malays there, you had Indians there, you had Africans there, you had Chinese there, I mean, Filipinos. I mean, it was truly a melting pot. And it was these people worked 24/7 because they accommodated their customers and clients all around the world, banking, technology, manufacturing. But I just loved the people. They were so genuine, and they worked hard, and they were straight up. I'm just saying unique. You know, I worked, and that gave me a footprint from which to springboard into all the other parts in that part of the world, from Cape Town in South Africa to Dhaka in Bangladesh, to Lahore in Pakistan, to Noida and just outside Delhi in India. So it was a true education for me very early in my career.
One of the things that I like the best about you is you don't necessarily get to talk about this in a Republican primary. So don't get me wrong, be it U.S. Senate or governor, but sometimes we don't always get to see the worldliness of who people are and where they come from. And look, that's the game everybody plays, and I think you know it when you get in, that nobody's going to care that you think Singapore is really unique. But it's part of what makes you who you are. As you transition later in your career from Reebok into working at Dollar General, what drew you to that? Because I think that business is so fascinating, because I live in Alpharetta. There's not a Dollar General anywhere close by. But if you drive across America, they're everywhere.
It is a fantastic American success story by the Turner family. Cal Turner Sr., started the business. His son came on, and then the third generation, Cal Turner Jr., was my predecessor. And they built a company, and the mission statement of that company was, we help people get from payday to payday. And I can tell you, I've studied brand loyalty my whole career. Reebok had damaged brand loyalty. We rebuilt it. When I got to Dollar General, they had the strongest brand loyalty I have ever witnessed in my life. It was because, as tiny as these little stores are and as messy as they get sometimes, they really did meet the needs of their customers. And I'll give you one little story. When I first got there, a lot of the executives had never run a cash register. So we had everybody in the senior management team trained to run a cash register. Then we asked them to go out and spend X number of weeks, a quarter, in a store. And then we came back after about 6 months and came back in and said, okay, what have you all learned? And one of the things that came out of that was a little lady in Texas told me, sitting in her kitchen, I said, we can't sell bleach. I see in your closet, cabinets here, you don't have our bleach. And she says, oh, your bleach is too expensive. What are you talking about? We have the cheapest bleach in the country. She says, oh, no, you only sell 32-ounce of bleach. She said, I can't use that in a week. That's a month of bleach. I can't afford that. And the light bulb went off, you know.
Yeah.
What if we sold 8-ounce? And so I went to the manufacturer. They said, well, we can't do that. I said, please try it. They tested it, and we did a test for about 6 months, and boom, it exploded, because people had cash, paid weekly, and they couldn't buy 4 weeks' worth of bleach.
Correct.
And so that's a story that I tell all the time to young people. If you want to be successful doing a service or selling a product, go talk to the people who are buying it, because they'll tell you what is good or bad about it.
When you leave there, and your cousin is at some point in that tenure the governor of the state of Georgia, correct?
My cousin was governor, yeah.
Yeah. So when you – how do you become – you're a guy who has got a ton of international experience. What drew you to the – talk about what you did with the Port Authority or the Georgia ports and how you got interested in trade and why you – what you learned and what you brought to the state of Georgia with that.
Wow, it was a humbling opportunity, and it was the most humbling challenge or job that I had in my career as being a United States senator, because it was about the people of Georgia, and what I learned in business was to listen to people. That's what we did at Dollar General with Bleach. That's what we did at Reebok with women's footwear. I mean, when we started making women's footwear on women's last instead of men's last, just graded down. You know, things like that come from the customers, like I said. So in what drew me to this, I was not drawn to a political career. I hate politics. I hated it before. I hate it now. I don't have a high opinion of most politicians. I don't. I don't. I mean, even now, I can tell you, I mean, there are certainly men and women who are doing this for the good of the country, the good of their people, but there are also a lot who are doing it for self-interest. Now, having said that, I just felt compelled in 2013 that after, at that point, 6 years or so or 5 years or so of President Obama's regime, that we were heading the wrong direction. He had told the world we were going to back up and just be another member of the Community of Nations. They cut military spending by 25%. We had the lowest GDP output over those 8 years of Barack Obama that we had had in U.S. history. So I went to my cousin. I went to other business guys. I went to people who I respect. I said, you guys, you need to run. Somebody's got to run for Senate. This is when Saxby Chambliss was retired. And they said, no, we're not going to do it. But, you know, a couple of them came to me and said, you need to think about doing this yourself. And I said, no, I can't get elected. I was a public company officer. I said, no, there's no way I could ever be elected. But long story short, I just felt compelled. Bonnie and I prayed about it and independently came to the conclusion that we had to give it a try. I didn't honestly think I could win as an outside guy. I'd never run for anything or anything else. And we put some people around us, and as an outside candidate, developed a mission statement that basically said, hey, these politicians have been there a long time. If they were really going to make a difference, wouldn't they have done it already? The port was a good example that I had been on the Port Authority. My cousin who was governor, asked me to go on that board. I said, Sonny, that's you can't put a family member on the board. He said, why not? You're the only guy that will be on that board that will have actually used that port.
That's probably true.
Business guy. I was. And so, you know, what it did is it gave me a perspective to add a little help. But the bottom line is when I got to the Senate, after 20 years of trying to deepen that port, I was able to get Trump to actually get this funded, and we finally got it funded. Just, I think, 2 months ago, they finished the deepening of that port after 22 years. And now all those post-Panamax ships that bring in tens of thousands of containers, more than were being able to be brought in before. Now the hottest thing going in Georgia is the economic commerce coming out of that port. It's amazing. I drove by there the other day. It's shocking how it's growing. It's the fastest growing port in America.
I have a question. So you, when you run in, it is no secret that you ran, and if you ask people today what they thought about your time in the Senate, they would remember that campaign that you and Nick Ayers or your team around you said, we're the outsider. We're the outsider that has run Fortune 500 companies. And I think that is really interesting. But I have a question specific to that campaign. Where did the jean jacket come from? And was that something that just... I still think that people probably see a picture of you with that jean jacket on, and I think that became synonymous with the outsider part of your campaign.
It did. Nick Ayers didn't have anything to do with that. this was an accident. We were shooting an ad in Bonair, Georgia, out in the middle of a soybean patch, and I was there with a blue Oxford shirt. It was cold. This was like February, maybe a little bit later than that, but it was cold. And I'm out there just a blue Oxford button-down shirt, pair of jeans and boots, and uh, in a soybean patch, and they were taking these pictures, and I had to give a line and all that, and they called a break, and I walked over to my truck, and I pulled out this old, I've had this thing 20 years, it's got holes in it during the end, and I pulled this jacket, and I threw this jacket, because I'd been working that morning, and so I put this jacket on, and Fred Davis, who was filming it, yelled and said, stop, because they were changing the cameras on it. He said, stop. And he said, walk out of the field. I said, what do you want? He said, go out in the field. So he went out in the field, and he started filming. So about 15 minutes, they filmed nothing but me walking back and forth in this soybean patch with that jean jacket, and the outsider was born.
That's awesome.
It was just an accident.
I figured with that that's one of the things that was either an accident that was totally free or cost millions. But it was one of the two.
It was totally free, and we drove it. You know, we had to build a brand. We knew it, and at that point, early in 13, we didn't have a brand. We just said, look, I'm running against these career politicians in the primary, and then eventually I'm going to run against a Democrat. But what I really want to do, the reason I'm doing this, is to try to change the direction of the country. You're not going to do that if you're part of the establishment. And so then it came, well, here's what I did in business. Well, you were always the outsider guy, the turnaround guy, so let's build this outsider brand. And it stuck. You know, I'd go all over the state, and people would have their jean jackets out and that kind of thing.
So that's awesome.
It was very gratifying.
When you sit in the United States Senate in that January of 2014 for the first day, and you walk in there, and it's like, I know you get your office ready and you've been there a little while. When you walk in for that first swearing in the session, what enamored you about sitting in the U.S. Senate that you didn't expect?
It was very humbling that every time I walked down to the well and raised my hand and voted, I was representing 11 million people. And I will tell you, it was sobering to me. First of all, you have this degree of inadequacy that, holy moly, this is real. This is big. This is not small ball anymore. This is the real deal. But I think the thing that I did, the first day in the Senate in 2015, I put a term limit bill in that sort of demarked me as not as a rebel, but just somebody that wasn't going to drink the Kool-Aid. And the powers there didn't like that. And but when I got there, I think there were somewhere around 60 senators who'd been there for 20 years or more, and there were 36 senators who'd been there for 30 years or more, and one guy had been there for 50 years. And I kept looking at that and said, well, wait a minute, that's not representative of the real world. And so I felt like they were losing touch with reality, and self-interest at some point and the drive to get reelected gets in the way of doing what is right. And so I kept screaming about that the entire time I was up there. But it was for me, with my background on Armed Services Subcommittee and having the Sea Power Subcommittee of Armed Services to help fund and rebuild the military, was very gratifying to see the cyber, the Army's global cyber warfare headquarters brought to Fort Gordon in Augusta, to see the Advanced Battle Management System global headquarters of the entire DOD brought to Robins Air Force Base, and then the Robotics Development Center of the Army brought to Fort Benning. I was extremely gratified to be a part of that. And then on foreign relations, to go all over the world and deal with these heads of state and their parliaments and their legislatures and all that was just a fascinating part of trying to serve the people of Georgia to help, protect our country, but also prepare to hand it to the next generation. It was a very humbling and sobering experience.
Can you talk to me, not to shift gears entirely, but can you talk to me about the brilliance of Mitch McConnell?
Well, let me say two things about Mitch. One, it takes a certain type of person to run, and when you're in the majority, to schedule and manage the Senate. It is an extremely difficult thing. To imagine if you have 50 in your own caucus, if you have 50 CEOs, in effect, and they all think they have the best idea in the world, and you've got to manage them. So it is a very difficult, difficult job. And he's been there a long time. I think he's in his sixth term. So on the one hand, you'd say, well, David, aren't you against somebody who is, a career politician? Yes, I think it's too long, and I've told him that. But you have to recognize the good things that people like that do. His heart's right. He's a good man. I know a lot of people don't like him. I disagreed with him on policy and on many levels, but I wouldn't want that job. I was more effective as an outsider in the Senate. And for the first 2 years I was there, I got very little done with Barack Obama as president. I mean, all we were doing is voting no to the Iran deal.
It's easy to play defense.
Yeah, but you don't get anywhere. I mean, you're basically treading water. Then, you know, nobody saw Trump coming. Trump gets in there. I was invited to the White House 2 weeks after he was inaugurated to a meeting of the Senate and House leadership. There were six people plus Trump and Pence, no staff in the room, and Trump wanted to lay out the agenda, said, okay, we're going to have the purpose meeting in the next 2 hours. We're going to determine how we're going to turn this economy around, get people to work again. And in 2 hours, it was a business meeting. We decided that we would go after regulation, energy, taxes, and Dodd-Frank, which is a banking bill that had, you know, hamstruck, you know, a bunch of banks, killed our community banks. And we had leadership, and I was the only one that wasn't in leadership. But I was, you know, the only Fortune 500 CEO in Congress, and Trump wanted me in there, I guess, because of the business background. But it was a business meeting that ended up setting the agenda that I believe created the best economic turnaround in U.S. history, and that can be documented. Healthcare was another thing that was talked about. Trump said we wouldn't get it done, and in fact, they didn't get it done that year, despite all the hard efforts. But that's the seed that was planted that actually bloomed into that turnaround that helped 6.5 million people pull themselves out of poverty, and we became energy independent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I think the thing that, and you probably, you may have never thought about it this way, but I think that if I had to give Donald Trump one compliment and only one, it was that he forced the Republican Congress and the Republican Senate to vote on all the things that they had always talked about. And I thought that was the one. You can accuse him of all sorts of things, and we will get there. But he kept his legislators accountable.
Well, he was an outsider like I was in Washington. He would always tell me, he said, you know, you and I are the only ones that really come from a different world. These guys have either been here too long or they don't have a similar background. He just came from a background where you get things done or you go out of business. And that was my background. I ran in fear of being bankrupt, I mean, or losing the job or whatever. I mean, that's the fear that kind of drove you in a business career. A lot of these politicians get in these, particularly in the House, they get in these safe districts, and they're there forever. And I just don't think that's what the founders had in mind.
No, I don't either.
I think for whatever vitriol that he had and the way he said things and all that, he's certainly a different personality than I am. But I give him full credit. I give him full credit for running the government more like a business. And he was so singularly focused on results. He didn't care about how we got there, and that got him in trouble sometimes. But he got more done in 2 years there. Those first 2 years, history will look back at that. And that turnaround, honestly, can be quantified. You know, I went there complaining about the debt. And in those two, that turnaround actually lowered the debt curve in those first 2 years, in 17 and 18, by $2 trillion. It really did. Now, COVID hit, and then the giveaways happened and everything else, and here we are again. But his focus was on getting the economy turned around and getting the military rebuilt, and he did both of those.
Do you have regrets, looking on the other side of it, and, you know, we're in July and the June number for inflation is 9.1, knowing that the CARES Act is, I tell everybody, there are cogs and wheels. It was a cog. And the inflation, you know, it's partly due to the printing of trillions of dollars across several different bills, and some of them you voted for and some of them you didn't. But do you look back and feel like that was the right thing to do for the country at the time?
Well, the right thing to do for the country in 2017 was to get the economy moving again. And, you know, you had a tax cut. That's what everybody talked about, the tax cut. But it was basically a reinvestment plan more than anything else.
Yes.
And that did get people back to work. I mean, like I said, 6.5 million people pull themselves out of poverty. So a lot of people will look at individual votes and say, well, this isn't consistent with what, you know, you were saying. Well, you got to look at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is, well, what are you trying to do? Long term. And you have to develop a long-term view to a $30 trillion debt. There's just no other way to do it. And the second thing you have to do is you have to start looking at your non-discretionary spending, Social Security, Medicare, and all of those things that go along with it, because frankly, those are untouchable. That's not part of the U.S. budget.
No.
The U.S. budget is discretionary. You know, the military is the biggest part of that, but you can't cut enough out of that discretionary budget to balance the budget. There's no way to do that. And what we were doing is growing to try to get revenues up, and that's what happened. Now, let me say one other thing. And at the time, in 2017, the economy was about $20 trillion. There were $6.5 trillion not at work in that economy. There were $2 trillion on the balance sheets of the Russell 1000, largest companies in the country, because of overregulation in the Obama administration. There was $2 trillion on the bank balance sheets of these community banks because of a bill called Dodd-Frank that forced them to have reserves like the big money center banks that were doing derivatives and all of the other.
Right.
When they weren't doing that, the local banks weren't doing that. And that was killing. We had lost, I think, 5,000 community banks at that point. And then the third thing, we had a unrepatriated U.S. profits overseas because of our tax laws. And I kept saying, if we change the tax laws, pull back on regulation, and change just a little bit of the Dodd-Frank reserve requirements for these community banks, we can free up $6.5 trillion. Well, you did that, and a lot of that money started coming back in over the next few years. In addition to that, then you had the Trump giveaway for COVID. Then you had the Biden giveaway COVID. So we've been awash in cash here for, you know, what, 4 years,
it's
3 years.
It's been hard.
Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're not done yet. So this inflation is partly due to having a lot of cash, but some of that cash was organic. It was already in the system. It was just tied up. So that didn't cause inflation. What's really causing inflation right now is energy. When you shut down the Anwar capacity, and you shut down the pipelines, and you open up and you back off the sanctions of Russia, these are all things that the Biden administration, I've been very critical about, not just in politics, but as a business guy. Why would you give up being energy independent? And then to see gas prices go from $2, I paid $5.69 yesterday driving my truck back from Atlanta. And, that was unnecessary. And that is if you look at the 70s, the big driver to a decade of inflation in the 70s was energy. And that's what we've just done. And it's emotional as well as quantitative or rigorous. But this is going to take some time to ring out. And I'm very frustrated with that.
When we look at the end of your term and you seek reelection, and you were around Georgia and you campaigned with President Trump here, how was that race different than your race in the midterm 6 years prior? What were the different parts of
Well, there were two things. One, if you run as a U.S. senator in a presidential year, what I learned is that nothing you say has much to do with your outcome. I mean, Trump, particularly because of Donald Trump, it just takes all the being the presidential race takes all the air out of the balloon.
Oh yeah.
Having said that, the second point is I still ran as an outsider to the establishment, and we backed that up, and we produced 90,000 more votes than the Democrat did in November, and in every other state but one, we would have been reelected. And I don't say that for sour grapes. It's just that's a fact. And so we got pulled into a runoff. And, then Trump was making a lot of noises about the election. And a lot of people lost confidence in the system. And a lot of people didn't come back out and vote in January. And that's all history. But the difference is it was the biggest difference running in the presidential year with any presidential candidate, especially one that garners so much earned media like President Trump did.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Well, you kind of alluded to it with him making noise about the election. And I'm going to ask you, and you can answer it any way you want. Is there a part of you that holds him responsible for Republicans staying home for your runoff?
You know, I hear people say that. I don't think so. I really don't. I honestly believe that what he was doing was genuine in terms of complaining about anomalies that nobody would answer. Now, the hyperbole of some of his supporters and all that outside the state that came in created confusion around the facts. And so a lot of people in the media never really talked about the evidence or the facts. And so from that standpoint, it didn't help. But he never said, don't come back out and vote or anything else. There were other outsiders that did, and I thought that was ill-placed. One was a Democrat. I don't know how that person got to be in a position of power, but I'm serious. I mean, he said Republicans shouldn't vote. They lost confidence in the system, blah, blah, blah. Look, I trust the people of Georgia. I've said that all along. I said it just now this year. The great thing about our system, it's bigger than any individual, and it's bigger than any party. And if left alone, it will rebalance. If you go too far to the left, it'll rebalance to the middle. If you go too far to the right, it rebalances. The three branches of government are very critical to that. The thing that scares me is that I've heard Chuck Schumer now many times in the last 2 years talk about having a vote to eliminate the filibuster in the United States Senate. If he does that, based on what he has said he wants to do, then you would end up with a one-party system. They want to add 5 seats to the Supreme Court. He has said that. They want to add D.C. and Puerto Rico as new states. They've already had one of those votes in the U.S. House already. And the third thing, which he said is their holy grail, is he wants to protect America, the Republic, he says, from racist voter suppression states like Georgia, I'm quoting, by having a federal Voting Rights Act, a voting bill. Well, that's unconstitutional, number one, but he is serious about that. What that would do is create a one-party system, and it would throw out of balance the legislative, executive, and judicial branches that have protected us for 230 years. The reason I say that is that if you then had a Supreme Court that wanted to legislate, then you would actually have an unbalanced situation that could not be rebalanced, no matter what the majorities were in the House, so in the Senate. So over a pretty long period of time, that's the only thing that bothers me about that.
When you look, and ultimately John Ossoff wins the seat that you sit in for 6 years, and you kind of go home and evaluate what you're doing, what made you interested in running for governor, and how involved was the President Donald Trump in that process with you?
Well, President Trump wasn't involved. He wanted me to run for the Senate against Warnock in that seat in January and February after the runoff. And I was concerned because the party was split. There were a number of people who were in the party. I'm talking about people who normally vote Republicans. They had lost confidence, and we saw what happened in the runoff. And I didn't know whether we would be able to get them back in November. And so I did not. I decided, and I told everybody, including President Trump and Mitch McConnell, that I was not going to run for the Senate. In fact, I had no plans to do anything. I actually told Governor Kemp at that point I had no intention to do anything, to run against him or run for the Senate or do anything except, get my life back in order. And that's what we did in 21. Our phones, our email, my wife and I, email, text, I couldn't go anywhere without – I'm talking about inordinate numbers of people, hordes of people who were, really talking to us about you've got to pull this party together. It's split, et cetera, et cetera. And the only reason I ran was to give the Republicans a choice in a primary to see who they thought would be the better candidate to pull us together for a run against who I thought would be the current candidate, Stacey Abrams. I felt all along she was going to be the candidate because I think the Democrats want to see if she can win a statewide race. If she does, she's going to be their candidate for president, I believe. And they ordain that more than Republicans do, in my opinion. You can see how Biden got to be their nominee. You can see how Hillary Clinton got to be their nominee.
They're very organized.
They're very organized. I mean, Bernie Sanders, by all intents, had more delegates, but by the nature of the people who were encouraged to leave the race in the latter days of the primary, Democratic primary, back in 20.
It's the machine.
Somehow Biden ended up with a nomination when Bernie Sanders really earned that. Same thing happened in 16 with Hillary. So my point is that I was giving the Republicans a choice, and that's all it was in the state. I didn't say anything that was untrue in that primary, but right now my only focus is making sure Stacey Abrams is not the next governor of Georgia. And I'm encouraging everybody that's listening to put any animosities aside, any differences aside, any concerns about the voting system aside, whatever, and look at the bigger picture long term. If we lose the state of Georgia to a Democrat governor, no matter what you think about the election process, we will not get it back in the short term. And that means that we could have a totally different situation nationally. So I'm imploring everybody who is concerned about the future of the country, not just the state of Georgia. They have got to vote, Ben. They have got to vote.
To that end, and I've got two more questions for you. After when you concede in May, have you spoken with or done events or plan to do events with Governor Kemp in the coming months?
Oh, absolutely. I'm doing everything I can right now. In fact, I just had a lunch just a minute ago trying to, help behind the scenes. Look, there are a lot of people don't want I want to be a help and not a hindrance, but I'm trying to a lot of people who are really upset with the governor, I'm in a position to try to help salve that over, and that's what I'm doing right now, is trying to tell people to look, you got to look at the bigger picture, no matter what you think. And this is what Jack Kingston taught me. Let me say this about Jack. Jack had been in the United States Senate 22 years. The U.S. House for 22 years. I ran against him in a primary, beat him in a runoff. The night of the election, he called me and said, "Look, I'm conceding. Congratulations, but the bigger thing, I'm in your camp. I'm gonna do everything I can to help you." He did, and now he and I are great friends, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what I'm trying to do for Governor Kemp. Look, Governor Kemp and I have differences. There's no doubt about that. But on the other hand, I understand who's going to be the better governor of Georgia, and it is not Stacey Abrams.
When you have accomplished an incredible amount of in your professional career. You've sat in the United States Senate. You're a household name in the state of Georgia. If you had something else out there that you wanted to do, and it could be anything, what's next for David Perdue?
Well, I don't know. God will direct that, I think. And, what I'm trying to do is just be available. I've got some personal things in my own business life that I need to take care of after 9 years of not participating in probably the greatest economic boom in humankind history.
You missed out on that?
I did it for the right reason. But at the same time, I have some responsibilities to my kids and grandkids. And, we're spending more time with family, and that's something I was not able to do in the United States Senate. And so I don't know what's next, but I'll tell you this, I'm not done helping the state and the country. And I believe that just like Saxby Chambliss and other ex, Doug Collins and Nathan Deal and others, Sonny Perdue, all these people who are now out of office, they continue to find ways to add value. And as an ex-elected official, I still have a platform to have influence, and I'm trying to use it right now to make sure Brian Kemp is the next governor.
David Perdue, thank you for spending time with us. I am so grateful that you and I sent you a text message. I tell people all the time, when I sat on the city council in Alpharetta, if we needed a letter of support for a grant with the Atlanta Regional Commission, your office at that time, I said, guys, I know that there's other people that have more power. I was like, if you call somebody in his office, they will help you. And I think that is a testament to your leadership. And, I would sit there and say, as somebody who knows how to use it, I understand wanting to spend more time with your family. I understand not wanting to, jump into anything right away. But, the best people in the world, they don't burn out, they rust out. And I think that you have it in you to be just a tireless, advocate for good things in business and in public service. And I'd encourage you, take all the time you need, man. But we're always happy to talk to people who have done what you do. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Ben. This is my, I have been asked to give interviews since May. It was very controversial that I ran, and a lot of people had hurt feelings about me running, et cetera, et cetera. But I think people who know me know that my heart was right, and we were doing it for the right reason. And now I'm in a position outside of politics to help, our current governor fight off this the liberal push in Georgia, and we're doing that. But I think right now the bigger picture is what is the future of America going to look like, and we all have to step up and find a way to add value. So thank you for allowing me this platform. Like I said, it's the first interview since the election. And
don't do any more. This is good enough.
Well, right now I'm just trying to quietly influence the people that can make a difference in November for our side, and I'm doing everything I can to make sure that happens.
Well, on behalf of Extra 106.3 and the Ben Burnett Show, thanks for spending time with me today, David.
Thanks, Ben. Have a great day.
See you soon. Guys, this has been another episode of the Ben Burnett Show. We will see you next week. Have a good day, everybody.
A lifetime of hard work. Children laughing in the kitchen, family photos on a restaurant wall, a legacy that lives on. It all comes from the power of a conversation, like the one Tommy Hall had with First Horizon Bank about taking over his father's Charleston-based restaurant business. Now the table is set for a whole new generation. First Horizon Bank. Let's find a way. Go to firsthorizon.com/Tommy. First Horizon Bank, member FDIC.
Support for Extra 106.3 comes from Natural Body Spa and Skin Remedy, celebrating their 35th anniversary and offering gift cards in-store and online. You can discover Mother's Day and anniversary presents online at Natural Body Spa and Skin Remedy at naturalbody.com.
Hey, sandwich lovers. Today's your lucky day. There's a whole new way to roll for lunch or dinner delight with Nucky's Hoagies in the Roswell Corners Shopping Center. Now open. Nucky's Hoagies in Roswell is family-owned and operated by the sub-sisters, Stacy and Shannon, whose love language is food and Nucky's Hoagies, their passion. When you bite into a Nucky's Hoagie, you'll taste the difference. The softest hoagie rolls ever, along with hunger-quenching sandwich combinations. Make Nucky's Hoagies in Roswell on Woodstock Road your new favorite spot for lunch or dinner.